Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So it's another Thursday at 3 o'clock. I don't know how when you're listening to this, but it's a Thursday at 3 o'clock when we do this.
Well, they could hear it on Thursday.
Yeah, we're doing it on Thursday at 3 o'clock. You're hearing it on Monday. There's nothing I can do about that. It's the way it is. A lot of things restrict my life, you know, like the clock.
Yeah.
You know, I have to be up to do certain things. I have to be up anyway.
Laws.
That's the way it is for you, too, I'm sure.
Gravity.
I want to welcome you. This is Norman Lear. And we are talking about all of the above. All of the above.
All
with
of
Norman
the
Lear
above.
Norman Lear and Paul Hipp.
A great guest.
His guitar playing, songwriting buddy.
Yes. And we have a great guest today, Mr. Stephen Tobolowsky, who is one of the stars of your new show.
The brand new show, a Latino version, Cuban-American version of One Day at a Time. It's a show I did a lot of years ago. Actually, there's no relationship between this show and the old show except the title. And Rita Moreno and Justina Machado, two of the most glorious talents I've ever worked with. And Todd, what's his name? Griffin? Todd Griffin, you silly Norman. Todd Grinnell. We could call the show Silly Norman. And it would get a laugh from Paul Hipp, but what are you going to do?
One Day at a Time on Netflix.
One Day at a Time on Netflix. And you watch, you know, at this moment you can watch 13. We're getting ready to do another 13.
Stephen Tobolowsky, not just one of the stars of that show, but also he writes books, he does podcasts, he tells stories. He is that actor with a big brain, and he is here.
All of the Above with Norman Lear.
There's a whole lot of good things happening on the Podcast One Forbes network. Forbes U30 is a show about young innovators, disruptors, and entrepreneurs, like the minimalists Joshua and Ryan, electropop artists like Lights, CBS Search Party star Charles Rogers, the women of YouTube's Clever TV,
plus many more.
And the Forbes interview is a deep dive into the minds of the folks who could be on the cover of the magazine, like Tinder founder Sean Rad, hero pilot Captain Sully Sullenberg, Moneyball author Michael Lewis, pop star Jason Derulo.
And the list goes on and on.
Subscribe or listen to Forbes U30 and the Forbes interview now on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
Brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Here's the way you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with a single click and find the best candidates for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Norman.
Now back to All of the Above with Norman Lear.
Stephen Tobolowsky is here. Am I pronouncing the last name
absolutely
as
correctly?
Well, as your family?
As, yes. Yes.
Okay. Tobolowsky. Anyway, a glorious comic actor. Actor, because I'm sure he can do anything, but he is so funny on the new One Day at a Time, the Latina version of One Day at a Time. I'm saying that to Paul Hipp sitting next to me. Paul Hipp, my...
And I'm agreeing.
My sidekick here.
I went to the... To see you guys film the pilot. We were talking earlier, and I was just saying how it was like watching you was like watching a clinic in comedy acting. How to come on, hit it, inventive, because I read the script. And I never saw it that way. And I didn't see the character that way. You know, I don't know what I thought of it. But when you came out, it was the kind of thing where you hit it, economy, funny, and then I couldn't imagine it any other way. It was like it was meant to be.
That's what you actors, don't forget that you are an actor also.
And I love when acting, that's when I get excited about it.
That's what you do. I mean, I ask this question often because everybody knows Archie Bunker and all in the family and so forth. So, yes, I write a script. I call it, actually, it's in the first edition, it was called, I'll give you the title in a couple of minutes as soon as I think of it, but it wasn't All in the Family. It became All in the Family. But I wrote Archie Bunker, who was somebody named Cunningham first. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I came to I came to calling him Archie Bunker. And Carol O'Connor auditions among 30 others. But when he walks in, and he's not off the first page before I know I have Archie Bunker. But I've never gotten over the fact that I didn't have what he did with it in mind. Hmm. I couldn't even remember what I had in mind, who I heard or saw. Actually, it wasn't anybody, because I wasn't writing it with an actor in mind. So the magic of living with a character that you've written until the actor comes in, it's like a robe hanging in a closet. You have no idea how, you know, it's interesting to look at. But until the right body puts it on and makes it his or hers, it's just a garment.
Yeah.
That's not good enough. I got to get a better...
No, but I was talking to Paul beforehand about the premiere or the pilot show of One Day at a Time. And one thing that was unique, and I believe we talked about it even the night of the show, is that I have never been involved in a show before in which there was such fellow feeling among people in the cast. Mm-hmm. And I think that's palpable. I think when an audience sees that there is actual love and concern of one person mm-hmm. to another on stage, it transcends, it goes through the camera and goes out. And I think that was one thing that made that pilot so special.
I couldn't agree with you more. That chemistry, you know, I think all the time, going back to All in the Family for a moment, about those four characters, the chemistry in every direction. This one with that one coming back with this one, the heavens, you know, you write it, but the heavens delivers that. And there's one other chemistry that always, we do it with a, as you know, with a live audience. And there's a chemistry that builds with those people who came to see live performers and the individual performer. And I'm not a performer. You are the performer, Stephen mm-hmm. Tobolowsky. Mm-hmm. But isn't that the richest? It has to be the richest feeling. I'm making it.
I think Norman
that
Lear.
That chemistry between the audience and the performer.
Yeah. Was it something you told me? It was either something you told me or came through you in a way that you like to use theater actors a lot of times in your shows because they ride the waves of a live audience mm-hmm. like a surfer. And to feel the waves of, I mean, you can't describe it any better, that the waves of laughter and the waves of empathy mm-hmm. that come from the audience at different times, you can ride those waves. And there is, it's a great feeling. I was doing a show on Broadway, Mornings at 7, uh-huh. Julie Haggerty.
Oh, remember her. Oh, so God. Well.
She was playing my girlfriend. We had about 3 weeks left before we had been on the show. The show was very successful. We were going to come to Los Angeles. And we were doing a love scene in which I never tell her I love her. And it's this whole scene saying, I should have said something before. I should have done something. And Julie is looking at me, and I look at her, and suddenly I couldn't talk anymore. And Julie is that kind of professional actor. She didn't try to usurp the silence of the moment. She stayed there with me. And there was nothing. Nothing happened. And then you could hear the audience start to be moved by the fact. And Julie and I rode that crest of silence for about 30 seconds, which in stage time is about, what, 115 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. And I had never experienced anything. And coming backstage afterwards, Ann Margaret came backstage, various people that I've loved. And they go, what was that? What did we see? And what that was the thing Stanislavski talked about was the kind of fire that happens in between the person on stage and the person and the audience.
Hmm. Yeah. Did you experience that at every performance?
Not like that, but every performance we had something like that.
Something like that.
Certainly yeah. Between Julie and I.
I think there's varying degrees of perfection in that, between the audience, the chemistry, whatever it is. And that's why an audience always feels like a different personality, how an audience has a personality.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what it is, and how's that personality mixing with ours? And so magic happens on those nights.
Yes.
Magic, to a lesser degree, happens on others.
Magic, romance. Both of those words come to mind. It's such a romance also.
Yeah.
The audience. I'm reminded of an episode of Maud. They're going, it's the anniversary of
B. Arthur, Rue McClanahan.
Rue McClanahan and Conrad Bennett. Anyway, so they go next door to wish them happy anniversary. What they don't know, because it's off camera, but in the script, off camera for them, what they don't know is that Rue McClanahan, has decided to be naked. She's wrapped in cellophane and naked when she opens the door. She's sure it's her husband, but it's them when they knock. So she yells, coming, when she hears the knock. Here I am, opens the door. Camera's on the back of Maud and Walter. She, McClanahan, reacts with a big, and slams the door. So what we have are the backs of these two people and a door and a slam door. And the audience is roaring. And the audience is roaring. And the audience is roaring. And then B. Arthur shifts her weight. And the audience roars as if something terribly funny had happened. They're so with the moment. This is where I think romance and love and, you know, there's nothing else going on in the world but this. And as the laugh is subsiding, she puts her left hand up and tweaks her ear. And I'm not sure she's doing it for a laugh. She doesn't know. And they're just so with the moment. And when we were selling Maud and having difficulty selling Maud into syndication, because this is true. God, I forgot about this.
Difficult selling
came
Maud.
Back. The salesman came back because they were meeting guys who were buying for six different stations, or who said two things that I remember very clearly. I don't want that. We don't need that Jew broad. A couple of those kinds of guys said that. And others said, I don't need that big bitch or that loud bitch or whatever. It's an interesting time to be talking about this. I didn't think of that when I got started because of everything that's going on, all the conversation about attitude toward women. But this was very much the attitude at the time. And when I put a reel together, I sold Maud because into syndication this way. God, I didn't expect to go this far into this story, but I love it.
No, it's great. That's why we're here.
There was a kind of the guys wouldn't buy it. So while we were making it, while it was on the air, the first run, I used to get a letter every now and then from Betty Ford, who was first lady then, and Mrs. Ford would write that she missed the show, and we would send her it wasn't a DVD then, it was a
VHS.
A VHS. and we would send her the VHS. But she would sign every letter, Moet's number one fan.
That's great.
So I called Moet's number one fan and told her we were having trouble selling it. There was a conference. I guess it was the early NatB. They were meeting here in Los Angeles. I said, I want to invite these guys to dinner. I'm going to get a weak response for me and B. Arthur. But if Maud's number one fan was there, I'm going to get a big turnout. Uh-huh. She said, give me 3 days, I'll pick one. I gave her 3 days in the period of time she wanted, in the course of this convention in town. And everybody showed. Everybody showed. I had to say to the Secret Service, I remember it was close to 1 o'clock in the morning, you can take her home, because everybody wanted to dance with her, and she was standing up, dancing all night long.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was just glorious. The next morning, they had agreed to do the evening and then a breakfast. And we showed it at breakfast, and a couple of key guys, I have to have it. They were not there just alone. Now, mm-hmm. The guys who bought for this, they were bosses, owners. So a couple of owners said, I have to have it. Mm-hmm. And that's how Maud got it.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's how she had a syndication life.
I love that. That's the way to get the job done, too.
Yeah. Do you know Steve Tobolowsky and his work?
Well, yes, I do. I'm a fan. I was telling him beforehand. Of the films, of the many TV shows. And then that's why it was so fun to watch you work on the show and have that revelation. Mm-hmm. That's when I love acting, when that stuff happens. And the live thing, which it's very clear on your show that pretty much everybody, I mean, you've got some real theater folks, on that stage.
I'll say.
Yeah, right. And that was very clear, too. There's something so fun about that. It's a very unique brand of theater, live television. We've talked about this many times, Norman and I. But where you get that trust with the audience, you get to know them because, and you go out, Norman, and do the warm up.
Oh,
Norman does not turn off his phone because he's a very important man. This could be anyone.
Where the hell is it? There it is.
This could be the First Lady of the United States.
Kate Lear?
It's Kate Lear.
It's me.
More important than the First
Kate Lear?
Lady.
Yes.
Hey, you are. You're on the speaker.
Hi, Kate.
And I am... Say hi so we can be sure we got you mic'd and everything.
Hi.
Kate, we started the podcast. At Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, usually around that time, we're doing the podcast.
Yes.
So you are one of the daughters that I say all the time, I tell my kids I will never turn my phone off. I don't care when they call.
Yes.
So I'm sitting with my sidekick on every one of these shows, Paul Hipp, and across from me is Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays Berkowitz. Dr. Berkowitz.
Oh, yes, of course.
Hello.
And Kate Lear is daughter number two of five. But she's daughter number one in my heart.
Because she's on the phone. If the others are on the phone, then they're no.
That's good.
But I don't want her to know that.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, everybody.
We don't know who in the world you're talking to, how many in the world you're talking to, Kate, but it could be hundreds.
I hope it's hundreds and many more. And please tell your guest that he makes me laugh hysterically every episode.
Well, thank you.
you know what we're going to be talking about, Kate?
He
has a book coming out, which you would have heard about from me in any event. Coming out April 18th, Simon & Schuster. And how about this title for a title that would attract your father? My Adventures with God by Stephen Tobolowsky.
Oh, my gosh.
How about that?
That is right up your alley.
I knew it was right up Norman's alley when I wrote it.
The name of my book is right up Norman's alley.
You guys are going to have an amazing conversation if you already haven't started.
We're being recorded. You are on the air, sweetheart.
You're in the show.
I'm thrilled to be on the air. I don't want to take up any more time of this precious conversation. So, Dad, I love you, and I called to obviously talk to you, so call me when you can.
What's the subject that may interest the world?
Ralph Nader.
Oh, he called?
Yes, he called.
He called me yesterday, Ralph Nader, and I said... I forgot what it was he was talking about, but I said, this is going on in New York, and the one person you should talk to is my daughter, Kate.
Oh, wow. Well, it's an honor to talk to him, so thanks, Dad.
But there's no reason in terms of my relationship with him why you have to go out of your way to do anything. So it's whatever he's talking to you about, is, you know, if it doesn't interest you, forget it.
Okay, thank you.
What is it?
Since we're on the air, everything that Mr. Nader does, I'm interested in.
But it's, you know, it's a podcast. We like to think everybody in the world will hear it, but probably 10% of them won't.
Are you guys planning to take over the world with Ralph Nader?
Zugnicht. That means, well, Tomolowski will know, this guy won't. That's how. Kate, I love you. I'll talk to you later.
Bye. Love you. Bye.
That's live podcasting.
Now, you want to know when this happened also? A year ago. I am at my little, a year ago. My sister has passed. I'm doing a memorial in Connecticut. A couple of hundred people out there. Phone is in the same pocket and it rings. I tell everybody. I have the phone on all the time because I want my kids to know they can reach me anytime. And I pick up, my sister's name was Claire. What I had going for me in the moment was that everybody that heard this knew she was a pain in the ass on the phone. She wouldn't let you go. You know? So I can't remember which kid it was, but I said, it was Brianna who was calling. I said, Claire? The place went crazy. Claire! How'd you get a phone there? What are you doing? And they howled. My kid went along with me.
That's great.
I don't. There are a couple of hundred people here. It's raining, okay? So maybe there would have been more if it wasn't raining. I don't know about the food. I'm just talking to them. Anyway, that's the way it went.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified candidates with immediate... Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Norman. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Norman. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Norman.
Now back to All of the Above with Norman Lear.
So, as I'm looking at my phone, our interview with President Trump on The Daily, a podcast powered by Times Journalism, we discuss Bill O'Reilly. I wonder what will have happened to Bill O'Reilly by the time this podcast is on the air.
I have no idea.
It's odd that should be so hard to tell what would happen. The world we live in, you know, this guy, because of the world he lives in, he could survive it. It might just be okay. in that world.
So we're going from Bill O'Reilly to God.
To God.
No, shouldn't there be something in between?
No, it would be Bill O'Reilly too.
I'll make that leap.
Another human being, another creature of the Almighty.
Oh, that's true.
But the title of Stephen's book, which I adore, I haven't read the book yet. I've read about 4 pages, but I can't wait to get back to it because I just bought it, knowing he was coming and knowing learning of the book. My Adventures with God by Stephen Tobolowsky, and the greatest reviews. I could read them, but I'll ask whoever's listening to read them.
Yeah.
But Stephen, it's wonderful. I can't wait to get to it because I keep reading. It's joyous and funny, and it's you, and you're just a regular guy with a regular relationship with.
Well,
that.
The genesis of it is that and people who know me may know this story, but I don't know if you know this, but I had a terrible thing happen to me in 2008. I broke my neck.
Yes, I read that.
Riding on a horse on the side of an active volcano in Iceland.
As you do.
So you figure, yeah, what could possibly go wrong there?
Literally, you broke your neck. So I think there's a big bone that actually broke.
Well, there's like 7 of them, and 5 of those 7 broke.
Oh.
And when I got back to the United States, the doctor said I had a fatal injury, which is not something you want to hear when you're alive. You know, as a writer, you know, it's a gross misuse of the word fatal. And
a total lack of empathy.
Total lack. So anyway, there isn't a lot you could do with a broken neck. I'm at home and I'm in the brace and my wife is doing everything she possibly can to help me. And suddenly I got this notion, what if what the doctor said was true? And what if I died on that mountain and that my kids would not know anything about their dad? And so in my recovery, since I couldn't act, I couldn't audition, I started writing true stories about my life that I wanted my 2 boys to know about their father. First love. First job, first heartache, dealing with oppression, everything you could think of. And these stories ended up becoming a podcast, which ended up going on national radio. And Simon and Schuster said, can we do a book of these stories? And that became the book, which is The Dangerous Animals Club. And after that book of short stories came out, Simon and Schuster called me up and they said, could you do another book? And so my answer, of course, was going to be yes, no matter what they said. And they said, well, your stories all have a kind of spiritual kind of bent to them. Can you write a book about faith? And I go, sure, no problem. Had no idea what I was going to write at all. So I said, absolutely, I'll do another book of true stories that center around human faith, of how the invisible changes our lives. And I came up with this metaphor. And I don't know if it's true with you guys' lives, but it's true in so many people's lives. I saw that almost everyone I knew, their life kind of fit the template of the Old Testament, that we all have a Genesis, which is kind of what we talk to people on a first date with a glass of Chardonnay, usually who we are, where we came from, what our parents are, what our aspirations are. And then we all go into slavery in our lives with first jobs, first love, sometimes with drugs and alcohol, or just being in graduate school forever. And then we
get, you're calling it slavery for a purpose.
Well, just we lose ourselves.
Uh-huh.
We no longer have control over our lives and our time and our aspirations. And we're miserable usually during this period of time, and we escape it eventually, like in the Bible, only to find that you're still lost in the desert. And then most people have a Leviticus moment in the middle of their life when they go, this is what I am. And it was at this time in my life I got married, I had kids, and I rediscovered Judaism. So all this happened in my Leviticus moment then. We're shaped by mortality, like in Numbers.
But you have to know Leviticus.
You have to know Leviticus.
In order to have that moment.
Yes, you have.
Okay, so I don't know Leviticus.
Well, I would.
And you're going to help me understand that moment.
I would say that you, of many people I've met in my life, probably know more about the Leviticus moment than anybody I've ever met, because central to the Leviticus moment is the holiness code and love your neighbor as yourself. And one of the central tenets of the holiness code is you shall not curse the deaf or put an obstacle before the blind. And you have done that almost your entire life. You have protected the people who had no protection, and you have been a spokesperson for people who had no voice. And that is the essence of Leviticus. It is the holiness of the human spirit. And that's where I think humanism comes from, is the essence of Leviticus. And then
Leviticus, just the translation, actual translation of Leviticus,
is Vayikra, which is he called. And it's interesting, the first line.
So there wasn't an individual named Leviticus.
No.
And there wasn't a moment that was called Leviticus.
The Levites were priests. And so the idea of Leviticus is that it is the code of how priests are supposed to act and the rules of the priesthood. And it's kind of the shortest of the major sections of the Bible. And a lot of people who analyze the Bible say that if you take a look at Genesis, you know, with Abraham and all that stuff, like historically that could have taken 2,600 years. There are biblical scholars that say Leviticus, the entire book of Leviticus, happens in one afternoon. Mm-hmm. That's how condensed that is. And it's also in the center of the Torah. And there is an idea that when you write a book, like I'm holding up my book now, you can't see it on a podcast, but I'm holding up my book.
And he's holding up his book. It's a green cover. It's very attractive.
And I'm turning it to page one.
And
we turn through the book, and we go from the beginning to the end. But in a scroll, you have to roll that scroll to get to anywhere you want to read.
Paul, I think there's a song in that.
Roll the scroll, man. Roll the scroll. Yeah. And so usually in scrolls, the center of the scroll is the most important part of the scroll because it's the most protected. And Leviticus is in the center of the scroll, and the holiness code is in the center of Leviticus. And I think, you know, well, I think a lot of things, but there's a lot in Leviticus that speaks to us today and is important in ways. But just to finish my metaphor is that after we're shaped by mortality, in like the book of Numbers, and like I lost my mother and so many of my aunts and uncles all at once almost.
You were very close to your mom.
Very close.
Yeah.
And then you get to Deuteronomy, which is Moses telling the story of the Hebrew people to the Hebrew people because they forgot, because they've been wandering in the desert for 39 years. Mm-hmm. And when we get to a point of perspective, hopefully we're able to tell our stories to other people to try to make sense of what the whole journey was about in the first place. And, and that was the template. And so then I just wrote funny stories, or mostly funny stories, that kind of fit that template of when I was young and when I first encountered God in prayers, and then later in my life when God became my dear girlfriend in college, and I saw God in her eyes, and that was during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And writing the book, I had one of those little Satori moments, because at that time, you'll probably remember this, I was in college, and we had that student deferment that kept us out of Vietnam, and then there came the vote to say, well, that's not fair. It's not fair that the people who are able to go to college get the student deferment. We ought to get rid of the student deferments. And we ended up with this lottery. And that night of the lottery, everyone sat around their televisions and their radios to see which children would be taken. Mm-hmm. And I had never experienced that in my life. And people in my drama class, one of my fellow thespians, His number was number 5. Mm. So he was going to go to Vietnam. Okay. And I was number 105, so I was in the second group. And it was right about then I fell in love. And I never put it together until I wrote the damn book, thinking like, man, life is but a walking shadow. And if I'm a walking shadow, I want to at least have been in love once.
Is it possible that we are, or each of us, life is walking in the desert, and we are each of us walking in the desert?
It's completely.
And that was the day the Jews were walking in the desert. That was the original metaphor. But that's what life is, walking in the desert for each of us, all together alone.
All together and alone. Now, this is completely interesting because we're coming up, but we're right at the season of time, which is Passover. And it's very interesting when the Jews leave Egypt in the story of Passover, in the Hebrew, when they go into when they're on their way leaving, the noun is singular, is plural, that they all go in. Mm-hmm. But when they cross the Red Sea and are out, then it is a singular. It is the same noun is used in a singular case, and so you have the many as individuals, and they come out as one. And I think there are so many things that divide us in the world, and the one thing that unites us is empathy. And one of the tools of empathy could be religion, could not be, could be religion. And another big tool of empathy is art.
It could be, yeah, absolutely. That's where I was going. I was going to start with music and laughter.
Laughter.
I always think about the 200-300 people we have in those audiences. Mm-hmm. When they're laughing from the gut, an audience has a tendency to rise out of their seats just a little, move forward just a little, and back. It's a wave. Mm-hmm. And in that wave, I could cry every time it happens.
It's perfection in humanity. I always think that. Like a great concert, yes, where the band is in concert with this huge group of people and everybody is one. And I always think, this is what I'm always searching for, this moment. Mm-hmm. And I love it. Or performing when the audience is with you. And you're feeling that. Talk about a personality of your, and that night that you had on stage, mm-hmm, where if I'm singing a song and the audience is with me and I'm with them, just as mm-hmm importantly. And so there's no wall between us. There's no performer. There's no audience. There's just us. And for that time, we get that. I think that is perfection.
Well, you know, Hebrew is a very deep language. Like, it doesn't have a lot of words, but the words they have many meanings. Like, a word that everybody knows is like shalom. Everybody knows that means peace and all of this. But one of the premises I have in the book is that people don't necessarily look to be happy in life. They don't seek to be happy necessarily, but they seek to be whole, to feel whole. And there are two ways you could feel whole. I had this dream, Norman. I listen to people who come to me and talk in my dreams, which is maybe crazy, but one guy came and talked to me in my dream. He said, there's two ways you could feel whole in the world. One is through love, and the other is through fear. And it's one reason why people pursue fear so often, which tends to separate us. And then there is another thing that love tends to bring us together. And I'm saying to the character in my dream, while I'm asleep, I'm arguing with this person who I loved who passed away. And I said, well, why don't we always go for love? And the fellow in my dream laughs at me as if it's self-explanatory. And he says, Stephen, because you could do fear on your own. And when we do fear, when we pursue things that make us afraid, we feel whole. And that is why addiction is what it is. It is pursuing fear. Drug addiction, any of those things. We pursue things in which we feel afraid because we chase the feeling of being whole. And
I think you said that we do not pursue happiness.
I think we think we like to pursue happiness, but then it does not explain all the things we do. That does not explain self-destructive behavior. It does not explain so many things.
No,
so
we start, but it isn't designed to explain that. Your pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of happiness, whether you fail or not. It's not designed to suggest you're escaping anything in that pursuit. Right. You are.
And isn't that the twist in the Leviticus part of the analogy, right? Isn't that where we've been enslaved? Is it Leviticus that we...
Well, in Exodus, we are enslaved, and then we kind of get out, and we get the Ten Commandments in Exodus, and then...
Right, and then we move on from there.
On to Leviticus, yes.
On to Leviticus. Yeah. So one could say in that word, we are in pursuit of happiness.
Well, certainly people pursue happiness a lot, but there are lots of... It's hard to explain crime, and it's hard to explain, you know, happiness for one person is certainly not happiness for several others.
Right.
So it becomes complicated. It was a major turn of human thought in the Enlightenment. The idea, they said, all humanity is that we pursue pleasure and we run from pain. And that's it. And that explains everything. And therefore, a good government is a government that provides pleasure for people and less pain. And that makes a good government. And that changed the way the whole world worked. And very much it is kind of framed in our we hold these truths to be self-evident.
The thing that I think of immediately as you say that is, but that's what both Democrats – in our society, and Republicans claim they're seeking. They both claim they're seeking the same thing. Right. And you said it, it can be said in other ways, but you said it as well as any Republican could say it or any Democrat. Isn't that correct?
Well, which part of it?
Say it again.
Just that we pursue what gives us pleasure. And we run from what gives us pain.
Okay. And so everything the Republican construct is about is for Americans to believe that they're helping them pursue happiness and running from pain.
And
the same thing with the Democrats.
And I think you would find in any political structure large doses of fear. Yep. One way or another. You have both parties demonstrating fear to groups of people to unite, to make them feel whole behind the banner of fear. And you've got to be careful, because if you're motivated by fear, you know, you could end up in big trouble.
Do anything to get out of it.
You could do anything to get out of it. And
or told and forced to do anything to get out of it.
Well, I have one other kind of idea in the book that I like, and that is, you know, we all think – because I try to mix science in here, too, because I always love science. And science and religion really do go together. But I find it interesting that we all know we live in three dimensions. And because of science fiction movies, we like to think that time is the fourth dimension. That's great. But truthfully, we live in the fifth dimension. And the fifth dimension is narrative, is story. Mm-hmm. What story do we think we're telling? If we think our lives are part of a love story, if we think that we're always going to lose before we get to the finish line, we're always beaten up or put upon, we create that story. And the reason why religion can be important and is that it can help create, it has the mechanism to create a more beauty in your narrative, just like art can, just like great literature can. And it creates a narrative to where you don't necessarily always feel like a victim. And you could find something beautiful.
Where does that part of the narrative that says, I believe, and you don't, I go to heaven, therefore you don't.
That's now, the way I look at it is this, and
believe in the wrong stuff.
Well, yes.
But that's right.
Yeah.
When, this is my idea on it, this is, I have no footnotes for this, but every time in the Bible, every time God meets man, it's one-on-one. It's not a group. The burning bush, all that kind of stuff. It Every time in the Bible when man encounters God, it's solo, one-on-one. It's not a group thing. And I think when religion becomes government, it can become very dangerous. That is where, you know, you have the Spanish Inquisition of saying, these are our rules and we're going to torture you and kill you if you don't do this. But it's the same thing when it becomes the communist atheist idea. When that becomes government, it becomes very dangerous too. So I think government has the ability to be dangerous. And when, like, I think anyone's spiritual path is individual. And even people losing faith is a very important part of the individual track of faith. Fine, you can lose it, but it's your journey.
What do you mean? You know, there's an individual at the table here who I hear in his music a real spiritual path.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask Paul. He's done it in each podcast. Because Stephen has never heard this.
Nope.
But my song.
Oh, that, oh, yes, my of song. Course. We walk around from room to room. You bump into me, I bump into you. I sing a song, you dance a dance. We lay down, romance. We drive the car down to the store. We buy some food, we need some more. We go to sleep, we dream the dream. And then I ask, what does it mean? What does it mean, this life, this night and day? And you say, go out and find a job, 'cause we got bills to pay and life is good.
And life is good.
And space and time.
And space and time.
Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine. We walked the dog, we cried and cried. That dog got old, one day he died. Where did he go? Oh, what a drag. He's made of sand, he lives in a bag, inside a box of piney wood. Some dogs are bad, our dog was good. I called the vet, good Dr. Dean. I had to ask, what does it mean? What does it mean, this life, this day and night? And you say everything is everywhere, and everything's all right, and life is good.
And life is good.
And space and time.
And space and time.
Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine. We watch TV, the evening news. I make some toast, I blow a fuse, I throw the switch, the power is on, the toast is hot, the ice cap's gone. We try and try, fail and succeed. Sometimes we give, sometimes we need. The waters rise and wash us clean. And then we ask, what does it mean?
Come on, say,
What does it mean? This life is night and day.
Night and day.
And you say, come here and rest your head. 'Cause everything's okay and life is good.
And life is good.
And space and time.
In space and time.
Give me some of yours.
Give me some of yours.
I'll give you some of mine.
I'm taking some of mine.
And life is good.
And life is good.
And space and time.
In space and time.
Give me some of yours.
Give me some of yours.
I'll give you some of mine.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, when something gets spiritual, there's no, you can't get more.
No.
And That's the way I feel about the song. And the next thing I might hear from you or what I'm feeling right now, what I'm expressing right now, is as deeply spiritual, I feel, as what I'm reacting to.
Right. And to create something like that, to write a song, to make a show, to do a scene, to write a book, is, you know, devoid of any ego. It's that moment where you sit back and you look at the page or you look at the show and you just feel there's no time I feel more useful.
Yeah,
being
yeah,
of service.
But let me just throw this out there too.
Like, this is why I'm here today. This just feels good. This is another version of perfection, and I find that's where God works for me. I once had a religion teacher who said, did you ever think, I was in eighth grade. No, I was a freshman in high school. He said, did you ever think of using your music, because I was a couple years into learning the guitar, and did you ever think of using your music to do God's work? And of course, trying to use my music to meet chicks.
That could be God's work.
But it wasn't until later when I went through in my life the slavery part of your thing, which was to drugs and alcohol, and I got out of it. And, but you know, with a power greater than myself, you know, I'll turn my will in life over to that and see how that goes. And all of a sudden, early on, when my brains were still scrambled, but I was free of that and I was moving toward the light and just holding on to whatever I could to stay there, that came back to me. Did you ever think of using your music to do God's work? And it was like a light went on. A light went on in so many ways because the music was what I've always been about. You know, and then that made it mean something. You know, we play clubs. A friend of mine said you put the little kid inside of you that fell in love with music and gets to come out and play when we work. It's one of the great things I think about what we do is we get to play like kids. The serious grown-up us takes care of the business, but we get to play on stage and writing and all that. Would you put that kid on stage and put cocaine up his nose and pour alcohol down his throat and then, you know, no, of course not, you know. That's what's happening. So anyway, when that came back to me, use your music to do God's work, it took the religiosity out of it. It made me it's not about Paul. It's about being of service. It's about being of service to the community, being of service to the audience, being of service to myself. Anyway, all this to say.
It's so hard to express it without it sounding like it's coming from the mount or something.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yes, that's what I'm trying for. That's why I'm sort of
verbose. Bring up one sort of thing. You know, when you say doing God's service, doing God's work, it assumes that we know what God is, which we don't, and that we know what His work is, which we don't. But let's deconstruct it.
Like porn, I know it when I see it.
Let's do it the other way around. Let's take that song. Let's take that song and the feeling I have in my heart when I hear it, you feel joy when you hear it. That could be part of God's work, but I want to talk about that dog.
Mm.
That dog is alive now in my head and in my heart. I feel I know that dog, and I feel your love for that dog, and he's here in the damn room. So is that part of the work too? Through art, we make things live forever. Not forever necessarily, but we extend what their life is, and
so,
we extend what their
meaning
is. So long
as anybody is using or seeing or watching or believing or enjoying or taking something from it, it lives.
And so the dog lives. The do not put a stumbling block before the blind lives. These things live, and it has the ability to create a narrative, which that song does, which is a narrative of love and unity and joy not for any purpose. I mean, the thing that makes me so damn happy about the song is that there's, hell, we don't know. I'll give you some of yours, you give me some of mine, and we'll try to be happy.
Mm, yeah.
And I'm filled with joy. I'm filled with joy.
But here's a point I'd love to get across. There's nobody listening to this. I don't care what he or she is doing in his or her life that isn't a part of this, that isn't himself, herself functioning the same way, but it isn't resonant. I mean, there's something about the fact that you wrote a song, but somebody else does something far less impressive in our culture. Tips a hat, I don't know, picks up a bag.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
cross,
yeah.
Helps somebody cross the street. Makes somebody smile, whatever. And that person has left a gift that's every bit as significant as that song or that TV show or that...
Absolutely.
Because this is one planet among what they tell us is a billion in a universe of which they also say there is a billion.
Billions of universes.
So billions of universes and billions of... So can you get your finger close enough to measure the impact of your song or what Jonas Salk left us? You can't... Or your song and Jonas Salk... And the guy who took our car this afternoon.
You know, there is an idea in the Talmud, in the Jewish Talmud, the 36. And it says that at any one time, there's only 36 people that stand in between us and the forces of darkness. But here's the catch. We never know when it's our turn to be one of the 36. It keeps switching around. And so the idea is, in your life, you have to always be vigilant because in that second, the man who tips the hat, the man who picks up someone from the street once, or Jonas Salk, at any one moment, it's his chance to be on the front lines of one of the 36 that protect us from darkness. And it's a charge for all of us.
To the pursuit of happiness, going back to that, or wholeness, the pursuit of wholeness, is happiness a component of wholeness or vice versa? Does it change? You know, because one of the things that I struggled with, believe it or not, when I got free and clear of all that, the drugs and alcohol, was the idea my life had been one long emergency for so long, you know, that's what I knew. And that's what I was comfortable with. So I started.
I know where you. I don't want to interrupt where you're going, but just in three sentences, tell me where you'd been before all of this.
Literally, you mean physically?
I mean, you'd been a big Broadway star.
Oh, I was starring on Broadway, concurrent with drinking myself to death and snorting myself to death, and I got a Tony nomination, all that stuff. So that was. But I was also. My understudy, who they called a hip replacement, he was the luckiest understudy on the planet because there was some times when everything that mattered, can you imagine missing a show because of this? Anything that matters, it doesn't matter. And then you think, that's as bad as it gets. No, wait a minute. We're going to destroy your relationship with your parents. You know, that's as bad as it gets. No, no, no. There's more, you know, until you die or you get it. And I got it, fortunately. I got the show ended. Hung around for the Tonys, didn't win. Jonathan Pryce beat me. I know, story's endful. No, I'm not. He's great. And then went off and took care of this. As I started to get glimpses of happiness, it was scary. In fact, I did a year of what I call research, getting a little bit of time, starting to feel a little bit of happiness, and then going out and destroying it, and then having to come back and go, I did it again, you know. Get back on feet. I didn't trust happiness. So a pursuit of happiness has been a big thing for me, you know. And to me, there's a bit of that is wholeness. That is. So I'm just interested in, because of the way you said it, I find it interesting. Is that a component of wholeness? Can it be wholeness? Does it matter? Because these are all just words anyway.
I think there is something in. Just in the Talmud, a little thing in the Talmud from Hillel, who was a great teacher about the same time as Jesus. Let's see, what is hateful to you, do not do unto your fellow man. He's saying, this is all of the law. This is all you need to know. this is all you need to know, and the rest of it is just window trappings. If what is hateful to you, you don't do unto your fellow man, not only will you be happy, but you will reduce unhappiness around you, and that's all you need to know. And that alone, that pursuit alone.
And that has been said so many different ways.
So many different ways.
And is basically the center of everything known as religion anywhere.
And that is why no matter how great or how small someone is in the social structure, if they hold that hand out to me. I had open heart surgery, right? Cedar Sinai, triple bypass. I didn't know this. They didn't have a nurse for me. They didn't have someone to be in the ICU for me. So they called in volunteers and a nurse who was retired. They called her at home that night. Nurse from Cambodia. Her name was Jane. I'll never forget her. And I was in post-op. And she just came over from her house. She's watching damn television, probably watching one of your shows, Norman. She came over from her house, and she sat by my side for 2 days. And
wait a second. She turned off my show to come over and
well,
save
she
your
left
life.
It on. She left come it. On. She left it on, probably put on the DVR.
You know, good.
You know, probably record. Yeah, no. Don't worry. It still was going to be, you know, Nielsen still.
The ratings are still there.
But it's terrible when they first have to clean you after surgery. It's incredibly painful because every bone in your body's broken. Well, your chest is broken.
Yeah.
So she was lowering me and she was taking off my clothes and cleaning me, and I was screaming because it was as much as I could. And she whispered in my ear and she says, "Dear Stephen, I know it hurts. It'll be done soon and you'll feel so much better." She helped me, and she cleaned me. She stayed with me for 2 days before I found out she didn't even work there. You know, they brought her in. You know, she used to teach all the nurses, and then later when I had recovered, she came and not only saw me later when I was in the cardio ward recovering, later when I was doing the exercise stuff to rehabilitate the heart and everything after, she came and visited me there too. And she would bring me flowers, and she'd bring me a little poem, and she would say, "How are you today? How are you feeling today?" And I said, "Thank you." And every time I saw her, the amount I was grateful was so magnified. I could not imagine that she had a place in her life for just to remove that little bit of grief that was and pain in my life. But I'm saying, who knows who she is? I don't know where she is now. I don't know how to, but that gratitude I feel for her, I throw out now into the streets. It's out there, and I know somewhere Jane will hear me, and she'll know that I'm feeling her sometime when she's blue. But that's the way it is. There's a connection between us that if we put out that kind of stuff, we'll get better stuff back.
But so you broke your neck in 1 year.
Yep.
And had open heart surgery
2 years. 2 years later.
Only 2 years later.
And my wife said, "Honey, can we finish with this hospital stuff?" You know, it was rough. It was a rough few years.
That is a rough few years.
Yeah, it was rough. But I, you know, here's another little thing, Norman. I don't know if you know the people who work on Community, that TV show. They had, I don't know how they heard this, but I get a call 6 weeks after the surgery, so I'm stapled together, and the people at Community had written a show for me to do on Community. Because one thing I never realized when something terrible happened, and the heart story is in the book. Not this story I'm about to tell. But one of the things you realize you're terrified of is that you're never going to work again. You know, what am I going to be when this is done? So they wrote a show for me to be a guest star on. The director comes over there. I'm there now. I'm stapled together 6 weeks after the surgery, and my wife comes with me. I have the blood pressure cuff, all this stuff. I'm in the trailer, and the director says, "Listen, we wanted to do this for you. Nobody knows. Nobody knows on the set what you've given. If you can't go on, if something's wrong, just like clean your glasses or something, take all the time you want. Rest. Do whatever you want. We're doing nothing today but your scenes. Just realize it's all going to be okay." And I didn't know these people. I was about to break down into two. And then Glee did it for me. Like 2 weeks later, they did a show for me, too. And it now it makes me, hey, what is it? You know, it makes me want to extend a hand to someone else, too.
Wow.
When I see that template that exists in our business.
In our business.
Give me a break.
That's amazing. I want your higher power. I got the flu and my agent dropped me. Brum-bum.
Nah, I'm just saying that there's a lot of goodness that can be in the world if you just focus on it a little bit.
How do we get the religions of the world to drop all of the nonsense and bring all the good parts together?
I don't think you have to worry about that. Just worry about yourself. If you worry about yourself, then everything else will take care of itself. I don't think you – because then you just become one of them. I'm saying like you stop
No. But you can't say that and then love thy neighbor, because love thy neighbor is more than just sitting home loving your neighbor.
Yes, yes.
You've got to be there for him or her. You've got to be there for your neighbor. And you got to be there for the next person, whoever the next person turns out to be.
Yes.
And expect them to be there for you too. That's I'm sure is the essence of all religion.
That's active.
But I think it requires action. You know, Bernard Shaw, I could have in my pocket, I could have, because I carry it around.
Oh, I love that.
In miniature, son of a bitch. Look at how many credit cards it takes to live. Here.
And a AAA card.
Oh, this is, I have the other one too. This is, you'll know whose prayer this is, Saint somebody. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. You're going to be able to read this better than
I don't have reading glasses.
Oh, Stephen?
Yeah, I got my reading glasses.
I might be able to make me a channel of your peace where there is injury or pardon, Lord. Right? Sometimes.
Let's see.
No.
Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. That there is where there is hatred, may I bring love. Where there is wrong, may I bring the spirit of forgiveness. Where there is discord, may I bring harmony. Where there is error, may I bring truth. Where there is doubt, may I bring faith. Where there is despair, may I bring hope. Where there is shadow, may I bring light. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Lord, grant that I seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen.
It is by dying in the self that one awakens to eternal life.
Yes.
That's what I'm confident it means. Hmm. But I love those words. Who's that? It's St. Francis.
So
this
beautiful.
This is a prayer by St. Francis.
We used to sing that in school, but they rewrote it.
So beautiful.
They did a rewrite on St. Francis. That's rude.
Yeah, well, yeah, he wasn't in the union.
Yeah. Hey, that's right. How was your SAG insurance through all of your health crises?
Were it was remarkable.
Fantastic. That's
right
what I want to
on.
Hear. Plan A.
Plan A, man.
You know, I would be remiss with all this religion if I didn't mention that for the last 8 years, I've gotten to have the good fortune, the pleasure of playing a character on a show called The Middle. And I play a guy called Reverend Tim Tom, who is a youth minister, a guitar-toting, song-singing youth minister. And it's so fun because I went to those 11 years. They asked me to leave for 1 year, and I came back to graduate years of Catholic school. And I have all that stuff in me, you know, all this information and nowhere to put it. And now I've put it, I get to write the songs and it all comes back. It was all in there and I get to write it in a funny way, kind of like what, you know, you've done with your book. So they'll call me up with the situations and Reverend Tim Tom comes and he sings about this. And it's been really fun. Again, talking about using your talent for God's work, you know, and it's been a lot of fun. There's one part of the Bible, you know, that Jesus was, there's a whole part where it's missing, you know, where he was a teenager. He was never a teenager. So I have a song, if I can remember it now, because Jesus was a teenager too,
beneath the pimples, long hair, and awkwardness, king of the Jews. A lonely teenage savior no one could understand. Dorky on the outside, but you know what? Inside, a wise young man, yeah. Jesus was a teenager too. Wasting his time hanging out in front of the convenience store. His father called all over town while staring at heaven's door. Is my Jesus with your Judas? What's this world coming to? Yeah, Jesus was a teenager too. His mother made him clean his room immaculate. Said everybody talks to me like I'm some kind of idiot. Well, you know, if you can perform miracles, tell me, what good is homework gonna do? Yeah, Jesus was a teenager too. Ah, I can't remember the, hanging out all day in front of the convenience store. I did that one. But anyway, that's it was from another from the first season of this show. But that's been so fun with that is, you know, the biblical history. Anyway, that's...
Just throwing this out, since we're talking a little bit about religion, the difficulty about talking about religion at all is that the ideas have come from different parts in human history that are like a layer cake, and a part of those times in human history, we thought we could know everything. We thought we could know the truth. And just as powerfully at other times in human history, we thought truth was hidden. And you have to, like, you know, smoke dope and you have to go to Woodstock and you have to do all this to see, go to the guru and get the truth. And so all of this is compiled of where we know stuff and don't know stuff. And I think we just have to be confident and happy with what we don't know as well as what we do know. And that's why everything seems like to not fit together, because it's different. You know, we don't know what Jesus was like when he was a teenager.
Right.
You know, but holiness itself, you know, the idea holy in Judaism, the word is kadosh, which means separate. That's all it means. It doesn't mean like Charlton Heston, you know, on the mountain. It means separate. That the idea that there are certain ideas and certain things that are separate. And in everyone's life, there is something separate and something holy.
When I think about, and perhaps I've said this in an earlier podcast, I don't know, but take a couple of hundred people sitting in the same church or synagogue or mosque or whatever, Sunday or whatever the day of worship is, after Sunday, knee to knee, mm-hmm. in the same pew, you know, reading from the same sacred text. Each individual's compact with that is individual, like no two snowflakes.
Yes.
There are no two compacts alike. Mm. You can't articulate. Maybe if you took a month, you could. But you can't articulate the individuality mm-hmm. of each of our relationships with that.
Right.
Which is one of the – yeah, so does religion – sometimes try and form that into something that is
well the
uniform.
The idea is, you know, when I went back to Judaism, like when I was in my 40s, is there's a lot of tradition. And the idea is that you were given tradition because traditions are fun. You know, to say blessing over wine and to say blessing over bread makes you happy. It's fun because you're drinking wine and you're eating bread and you're saying a blessing and you feel like you've said thank you, like I would say to my woman Jane, you know, who helped me there, that you're always saying thank you through your life. And so you're learning appreciation with every little thing you do. And appreciation is really the most difficult thing to learn in our life. And I think if we learn appreciation, a lot of other stuff just goes by the ways. Then you don't have a problem with a lot of things.
Right.
I like the metaphor of a 1,500, 2,000-mile river. The climate changes along the banks of 1,000 miles. You know, the climate change, with the climate changing, the shrubbery, the whatever the vegetation is along the banks of the river changes with the climate. But it's the same water that nurtures everything. And that's the essence of religion to me. Mm-hmm. What the what nourishes us in every religion. If only we could stick to that, believe what we want to believe and not inflict it or press it or on anybody else. Keep it in the family where people who feel, you know, speak the same way, but allow it to be nurtured by the water that nurtures all religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah, that's the funny thing is, why do I need your religion? Why do I need to give you my religion? Why do people need to? It should be a thing of attraction, correct?
Well, the all I was trying to say, like in the book, with the stories in the book, is that we're shaped so much by the invisible. We like to think we're shaped by certainty, but we're shaped by the invisible. Everywhere we turn, we run into the wall of no certainty at all. We don't know anything. We don't know where we come from. We don't know where we're going. Like your song, we don't know why we're here or what our purpose is. It's like we're shaped by something bigger than just what we're certain of. And you can't inflict, there's no reason to inflict uncertainty on everybody else. They got their own. Hmm. So it's a matter of dealing with that. And I think, you know, Judaism, for me, has a lot of beauty in it in dealing with the uncertain. And all of us with belief, whether it's to God or something else, you know, I don't know if you know, Norman, but in the Old Testament, there must be like 41 different names for God. I mean, God doesn't have a single name or a single manifestation. And sometimes the name is Lord, and sometimes the name is God of the mountain, and sometimes it's the destroyer, and sometimes the name is God of mercy. And the question is, which face of God, which word of God do you, you know, are you going to grab on to the destroyer, you're going to grab on to God of mercy, and or God of peace?
A few days ago, it'll be some time ago from people hearing this podcast, but they're likely to remember that in Syria, they chose to use gas to kill some innocent people. I forget how many. And it's the most extreme, most damaging to me footage I've ever seen. You know, six-year-olds gasping for air and dying as the camera viewed them. I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear it. Listen to me talking about I couldn't bear it. Jesus. Anyway, it was. And I ask myself in moments such as that, but wait a minute, where is God for that individual? And there is an answer. And all I can be is confident that the answer is something I will love.
Yes.
As difficult, impossible as it is for me to believe it as I see it. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact is it's happening to that child. But there's an answer someplace. I don't know if there was anything clear about what I just said.
No, completely.
It was beautiful. That brings us back to the book.
I just want, you know, in Adventures with God, I met this guy from Auschwitz when I was mourning my mother, and I did the 11 months of two times a day of going to the synagogue and doing services, and I ended up friends with this survivor from Auschwitz, and we became buds until he passed away. And I have his story in the book, but I mean, my God, what he went through, and the amazing. I mean, he watched his family being slaughtered as they got off the train at Auschwitz, and he.
What were they doing? Firing at them?
No. What they do is, he said, when they got off the train, they take the men that are able to work, they go into one, and then they take the girls and the old people, and they go on the other line, and then they're gassed, and then they go to the crematorium. And so they just split them up. So he sees them go away, and that was the last he ever saw them. And as I'm talking to him, playing cards with him and drinking whiskey with him over the years, I said, did you ever have a good day at Auschwitz? And he says, oh, Stephen, yes, so many. He said, there would be times we'd be on a road and I would smell something nice, or the sun would be beautiful, and I fell in love. I said, what? He said, I fell in love with a woman in the woman's side of the prison. I said, you fell in love at Auschwitz? How did you even see her? He says, because my two German guards had girlfriends there too, and they didn't have basic schooling. They couldn't write, and they couldn't do arithmetic, so I would do all their reading and writing for them so they wouldn't get sent to the Russian front and die, and they protected me. And he said, if I were to see, he says, let me tell you the one thing about my two German guards. They were kind, Stephen. They were kind. And I would give them anything if I saw them to this day. Kindness is something that I don't think is a necessary gift among human beings. And Syria is an example of that. I think you cannot – they did an experiment. They did an experiment. I don't know if you've heard of the Milgram experiment, where they used to have somebody in a doctor's coat telling people to – pretend to torture people, like give them electricity, and they had actors in another room scream and all this. They had another form of the Milgram experiment where they would pay people to torture someone in a room, give them electrical shocks, and the more they gave electrical shocks, the more money they would give them. And everybody going into the experiment said they would never shock anyone. They would never, ever do that. But when the money came on the table, they did it, but they found that there was a difference. When the camera on the victim only showed a hand or a foot, the people would shock, and they would shock more and more and more. But if they showed a face, they would not shock. And the idea I grasped from this is that maybe evil is the inability to see the human face. That when we see the human face, that we cannot do these acts of cruelty. We cannot do it. And so through our lives, in terms of what you were saying about being service to God, maybe the being service to God is by looking more at the human face and seeing the human face more. And then you are in service.
I love that. And you're an actor too. This is unbelievable. Too much talent in one man.
How you get? You don't follow this. You conclude with this.
Somehow that's unbelievable.
We find a way to conclude with a Stephen.
Well, your adventures with God are – this is just a taste of it.
But the stories are funny.
I cannot wait to read the book. Well, that's such a positive message, and it's such a great storyteller. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have the book. I'm amazed that I didn't bring it. We're finished.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
And life is good, and space and time, give me some of yours.